which that can occur is dimension 3. And so we'll be studying theories in dimensions 3, 2, and 1, dimension 2 and 1 by reduction. So far we've seen a theory with one supersymmetry and just in one dimension, although a little challenge, you can try to write down the theory in two dimensions with 1, 0 supersymmetry. So yesterday was a very soft lecture where I, well, they're all soft in some sense, but where I gave you a qualitative survey of the land of the different supersymmetry algebras and so on. So today there will be a few more formulas. And but let's start out by discussing the, just in very general terms, the bosonic theories that we'll see, namely the sigma models and the gauge theories, before we write down the super one. So yesterday, I, at the very end, wrote down the Lagrangians for a free scalar particle and a free vector particle, or free connection, and showed you how you quantize. But let me write down the classical models, which are the more general ones, which are nonlinear and interacting. So the field in a sigma model will be a function from Minkowski space to x, where x is some Riemannian manifold. And so I write Minkowski space this way to distinguish from the superspaces, which we'll see. So the other piece of data is a function, a real function, which is the potential energy. So this is the data which goes into the sigma model. And the Lagrangian is then 1 half d phi squared minus d phi dnx. So dnx means the standard density on Minkowski space, the density which is invariant under the Poincaré group. And on Minkowski space, I'll use the coordinates x0 through xn minus 1, where x0 is the time direction and the other xi's are the space directions. The equation of motion, which describes the space of classical solution, is the wave equation, but with the potential term, we get the sort of higher dimensional version of Newton's law. So you remember that Newton's law in one dimension says the mass times the acceleration is minus the derivative of the potential, and that's the generalization, which you can easily work out. And now, there's one more important formula. So when we did the mechanics, I worked out for you the conserved charge associated to the time translation, which is just minus the Hamiltonian. And in higher dimensions, the same thing happens. If we work out the conserved charge for time translation, we get minus the energy. And in fact, there's a local form of that, which is what we talked about with Noether currents. So you actually get a current, which you integrate to get the energy. And so that's the energy density. And the energy density is 1 half d phi dx naught squared plus the sum over the spatial directions of 1 half d phi dxi squared plus the potential d of phi. And then this is a density in space. So they're n minus 1. It's dx1 through dxn minus 1. So this is the standard formula. This is the kinetic term. This is phi dot squared. This is like the velocity. And now we have a potential term, which the field itself has sort of self-energy by the spatial directions. So instead of just a particle moving, we now have a field in space, and it can have energy even without an external potential. So this total term here is what you should think of as the potential energy. And this term is the kinetic energy. Now, in any system that the physicists study, you're interested in the space of vacua. So, for example, that's been largely the subject of David Morrison's lectures in much more complicated theories, is finding the moduli space, parameter space, of these string theories. From the point of view of the field theory, you might think of it as the moduli space of vacua. And classically, what you're asking for are field configurations which have the minimal energy and which are static in time. They don't move. So the energy will be constant. Well, saying they're static is just saying that this derivative in time is zero. So that will also be minimal energy. I mean, it will be static. We'll make this term disappear. And now trying to minimize this term, well, making this is a sum of two terms. Make this term is non-negative. So making this disappear just says that phi is a constant. So when we have a scalar field and we want to minimize its energy, we need it to be constant value. And then what constant value should it take? Well, it should be at the minimum of the potential. Now, typically, we'll normalize the potential, or we can normalize the energy. Anyway, we'll normalize the potential by shifting it so that the minimum occurs at zero. So the classical moduli space, well, unfortunately, I used script M there, but OK. So the moduli space, what's called the moduli space in this context of classical vacua, is then just the inverse image of zero. So this is assuming that V is bigger than or equal to zero. We'll see that in supersymmetric theory, supersymmetry always guarantees you that the energy density is non-negative, and this potential will be in particular non-negative. Okay, so that's a consequence of the supersymmetry, that time translation is basically a sum of squares of the q's. And we saw that for the simple algebra last time. Okay. Finally, in this model, we might have global symmetries. So in addition to the Poincaré symmetry, we can have global symmetries. Global symmetries are the isometries of x which preserve the function v. Those are manifestly symmetries of the model. Those are global symmetries. OK. Now, in a gauge theory, so the data, to begin with, in a pure gauge theory, is G, which should be a compact Lie group, and we should have an invariant of a bilinear form, an inner product. So this is an invariant inner product on the Lie algebra. Okay, so for a simple group, there's one up the scale. And the field is then just a connection, sort of G connection. So that means that it's a principal G bundle over Minkowski space together with a connection on that bundle. And now the space of fields, well, really, you know, you have a notion of gauge equivalence. I mean, it's really a category, meaning that if you have a bundle with connection, then you have another bundle with connection. You have maps between them. So really, the set of fields is the set of equivalence classes of these. In other words, fields module gauge equivalence. And the Lagrangian is then minus 1/2 the norm squared of the curvature, and again, times this invariant density. Okay? So the sign there, if you write it out using the Minkowski metric, you'll see that that's the correct sign, and even gives you the right normalization for the kinetic term. And the equation of motion that defines the, so the equation of motion is, of course, the Yang-Mills equation. And we also have, of course, the Bianchi identity, which says that the derivative of the curvature is zero. And okay. And now, normally, the physicists separate out the, when you write the curvature, you separate out the time components from the space components. In other words, you write this as dx naught, which is the time component, times a one form, which is the electric field, which then doesn't have any dx naughts in it. And then all the two-form terms with the dx naught make up the magnetic field. So if you break the curvature up into electric and magnetic field, then you can compute, again, the energy density. And that's going to be the classical formula, the sum of the squares of the electric and magnetic fields. So if the group is abelian, then this is, of course, the Maxwell equations, and this is the standard form. And it
we are working over what sort of a
over Minkowski space. I'm always working over Minkowski space. Yeah. So this is over Minkowski space. It's honest physics. And if you really do the U1 case, or R star, whatever, doesn't really matter classically, then these are really Maxwell's equations. And this is the classical formula for the energy of the electromagnetic field. And if you work out the conserved quantities for the other elements of the Poincaré group, then you'll discover the Poynting vector and all these classical quantities. There is a little bit of a subtlety here. You won't actually get quite this formula, but let me not talk about. There's a subtlety about the energy momentum tensor, something called the correction due to, Belenfante, which comes in here, but that's a little bit off the topic. Okay, so the most general gauge theory will not only be a pure gauge theory where I just have a connection, but also coupled to the sigma model. So the most general theory, before we put in gravity, so the kind of theory we'll see, the starting data will be G, the Lie group, together with this inner product on the Lie algebra. We'll have X, as before, Riemannian manifold, and we'll again have our potential function, but now we need to assume that it's G invariant. Okay. So of course I should have said that GX on the manifold X, and it acts by isometries. Now, we could make them uncoupled, which means we could just take G to act trivially on X. Then we're just completely uncoupling the, I mean, we're not coupling the gauge field in the scalar field, but in general, they'll be coupled. And then the fields are a connection, and then a field phi, which is really, if this is a connection on a principal bundle, then because of the G action, I have an associated bundle whose fiber is typical fiber is X. And now phi, rather than being a map from Minkowski space to X, is a section of this bundle whose typical fiber is X. So if this is a connection on some principal bundle over Minkowski space, we could think of this as a map from the total space into X, which is equivariant. That's the same thing as to say it's a section of the associated bundle. And now the Lagrangian is just what you get by combining these terms. So we'll have the piece from the gauge theory, and then we'll have the piece from the sigma model, except now, of course, this is the covariant derivative. So that shows you the coupling between phi and A, and then we have the potential term still. So the general thing will look like that. Again, you can compute the energy density and so on, and you find that the moduli space, well, I neglected to say over here that the minimal configuration is where the electric and magnetic fields both vanish, and therefore the connection is flat. And so over Minkowski space, if it's defined everywhere with no singularities, then the connection is just gauge equivalent to the trivial connection. The same thing here, and now we again want our scalar field to be a constant, and again at a minimum of V. And so since the gauge field is trivial, we can think of phi as just a map to X once we trivialize. And so again, phi takes values at the minimum of the potential, except now we have the global gauge transformations G, which act on the moduli space, and we divide out by the global gauge transformations. So the moduli space now is V inverse of 0 about the quotient by G. And again, this model might have global symmetries. The global symmetry group are the isometries of X, which preserve the potential V and commute with the action of G. Okay, so that's just a general picture, a very simple picture of what all these models are. So any model that just has scalar fields and gauge fields before we put in the fermions will look like that. Okay. Now, one more preliminary topic to discussing these models is to look, as we said yesterday in general, to see what the particle content is. We might look at the representations of the Poincaré group to see what kinds of representations we can have, the representations of the super Poincaré group. So we're looking in three dimensions with two supersymmetries. So remember that spin 1,2 is isomorphic to SL2R. And so the spin representation is just the two-dimensional representation of SL2R. So we have two, we have real spinners in this case. And so we build up our supergroup, P/2. Think of that as the Poincaré group with two odd directions.
Why did we do, why are we going to three dimensions?
Because those are the models we're studying today. You walked in late. All right. So the rest of the lecture is about models with two supersymmetries, which occur in three dimensions. All right. So So we have the both massive picture and we have the massless picture. And here we could actually try to draw what the orbit looks like. So this is a picture in the dual of the translations, the characters, infinitesimal characters. And we have the little group, if we sit at some point on this orbit, then we have the little group, well, the little algebra, let's say. Well, OK, better little group. So the little group here in the massive case is spin 2. And the little group here is spin 1, which is just Z mod 2. And this is without the supersymmetry. And so without the supersymmetry, well, we can have representation spin 2 is just the circle group. So we could have, for example, any representation is one-dimensional. So we can have a scalar particle, which is the trivial representation. The representation, which is the sort of identity representation that's labeled as spin 1/2, is the fermion, massive fermion. And then we have the spin 1, which is the massive vector. So we have all those massive particles. Here, for the group Z mod 2, we just have two representations. One is the trivial one, which is the scalar, and one is the non-trivial one, which is the fermion. So we have the massless scalar and the massless fermion. Now, you might have asked me what happens to the massless vector, because in terms of fields, I can certainly write down a U1 connection in tree space and quantize it, and then we're supposed to get a representation of the massless group. And this is really the first example you see of one of these dualities, because the representation you get of Poincaré turns out to be the same as the scalar representation. So that's first example you see where you have two different realizations in terms of fields, which when you go over to the particles and look at the representations, you get the same one. So in three dimensions, the massless scalar and the massless vector, when you go through it, give you the same representation of Poincaré. So that's a little exercise, which is really the first. You could ask as field theories, how do you see that those are the same? That's a different question. But you can go through the exercise and quantize those to see that you get the same representations of Poincaré. That's an easy exercise. OK, so now if we add supersymmetry, well, let's just add it in green here. So now we have two supersymmetries. And so our massive little group not only is this spin 2, but we also have these two supersymmetries. Well, okay. So let me just write explicitly Q1 and Q2. And here again, we have Q1 and Q2. So those are the two supersymmetries. And you remember when we have the massive thing that we have to represent the Clifford algebra. So if we're standing at this point, the pairing on these, which pairs to momenta, the momenta have a definite value here. And so we get a scalar pairing, which gives us an inner product on the Qs. And then we have to represent that Clifford algebra. So this is a Clifford algebra with two generators. And the minimal representation, so in the massive case, we get a representation, which is a graded vector space. And the minimal choice is to have the dimension of W0, so of course always equal to the dimension of W1. And each of them can be one-dimensional. So that's how we can realize a Clifford algebra with two generators. This is complex. And now it also has to be a representation of spin 2. And W0 will be the bosons, W1 the fermions. And so the spin 2 representation, well, we can have J equals 0 here and J equals 1/2 here. And if you work it out, that's consistent with the way this acts on this. Or we could have J equals 1 here and J equals 1/2 here. So they'll differ by 1 every time you somehow move in the Qs, the spin changes by 1/2. So there are two possibilities here. And this is called the, so here, what are the particles? We have a scalar particle, and we have a fermion. And here we have a vector particle, and we have a fermion. So those come together in pairs when you have the supersymmetry algebra. And of course, that's the general pattern. When you represent the supersymmetry algebra, you get the same number of bosons as fermions. So the particles you see separately without the supersymmetry now come in what are called multiplets together. And so this one is called the scalar multiplet. And this one is called the vector multiplet. So the word vector is used for one form or connection. And these are both massive.
Okay.
Well, the spin 2 is a subgroup of spin 1 2, which is SL2R, and that's acting on the Qs. So now you work out how it acts. I'm not going to try to tell you that at my fingertips. But yeah.
Yeah.
How do I what? Well, this is an orbit of the Poincaré group. The mass is just the energy, which is on this axis squared, minus the momentum squared. So so if I go to a point with zero momentum, it's just the energy at that point. So here, I mean, it's that sum of squares is constant, difference of squares. Okay. And in the massless case, what do I want to say? Then in the massless case, this remember that that Clifford algebra is degenerate. And so we actually get a Clifford algebra with only one Q. Some combination vanishes, depending on which point you're at. And so we get a Clifford algebra with just one generator. And nevertheless, the minimal representation, of course, that's the smallest thing we can have, still has dimension of W equal to 1. And now there's, of course, only one choice, which is to have, again, J equals 0. Well, OK, what does it mean? So here we have the little group is Z mod 2. So that has to act either by plus 1 or minus 1. Well, you can call that the helicity if you want, I guess. But anyway, it has to act as plus 1 on the boson by spin statistics and minus 1 on the fermion. And so again, we get here a scalar and a fermion, a spinner, is what I mean to say. Or, as I said before, we could think of this as a vector, meaning a connection, and a spinner. But by duality, these are the same. And so this is the massless scalar multiplet. This is the massless vector multiplet. But again, by duality, they're the same representation. As fields, we'll see them differently. But they're the same representation as particles.
Why is the scalar plus one representation?
Well, all I mean is, what should I call it? It's the it's the trivial representation of spin 1. Sorry. And the other, so I mean, I would really call it J equals 0 and J equals a half. But the group here is just that. So I don't know how you should call it. OK. Now, one more thing to say before we go over to the fields, which is that we're going to reduce the theory in three dimensions to two dimensions. And in two dimensions, so we're going to look at the Poincaré algebra in two dimensions. And when I reduce, remember, in two dimensions, we have that the there are two, the spin group is spin 1, 1, which is just R plus, and there are two inequivalent representations, S plus and S minus. We have this picture of right movers and left movers. And so here we're going to have one of each kind of supersymmetry. So we're going to have a Q plus and a Q minus. And the bracketing is that when I square either of them, I'm going to get the translation in that direction. So if this is now a picture of Minkowski space, we have a vector field in this direction, which is d plus, and a vector field in this direction, which is d minus. And the sum is equal to what I would call d naught, which is the time direction, and their difference is d1, which is the derivative in the spatial direction. So these are the light cone coordinates that Robert Dicegraff was using. And now remember that in the standard algebra, these two commute. But we have the possibility of a central extension, as I remarked yesterday, where these things don't commute. So we have the possibility of a central scalar Z. Now, if you just work it out, very simple exercise in this algebra, that if I take the square of the sum or the difference of these two, then this is equal to minus 2 d naught plus or minus twice the central charge. And now remember that when we represent these as operators, minus the time translation gets represented as the Hamiltonian. And the Hamiltonian is positive. OK, well, you see, the Hamiltonian is positive. But even more, this thing is a square. And now if you go through the sign conventions, well, These get represented as skewer joint operators. But nevertheless, when you go through, you'll find that the operator here has to be a square. And so the eigenvalue of the Hamiltonian, plus or minus the central charge, has to be non-negative. So, in other words, what you find... Yes, there's an I in there. I'm finessing that. When you go through the sign conventions and cancel the I's, what you find is that the mass is bigger than or equal to the absolute value of the central charge. Okay? So again, it's the energy, which is the eigenvalue of the Hamiltonian corresponding here, but we can just take a state with zero momentum, and then the mass, the Poincaré invariant statement is that the mass is larger than or equal to the absolute value of the central charge. That's what's called the BPS bound. So that's the simplest example of the BPS bound, and you see it's just a consequence of the Lie algebra. So in this context, it's just a consequence of the Lie algebra. And now what that means is that when we have a massive representation, when we have a massless representation, the central charge has to be zero. So the first comment is that in an irreducible representation, the central charge is a scalar. Of course, it's central. And that scalar has to be zero if the mass is zero, if we're in a massless representation. If we're in a massive representation, that scalar is bounded. And now if it's equal to this bound, if we have equality here, then that means that the bracket, the square of these, vanishes. So that's a supersymmetry. This particular combination is one of the supersymmetries that actually vanishes on the state. See, that's what happened in the massless case. We had that one of the supersymmetries vanished, or half the supersymmetry vanished. And here again, we'll have in this simple example that half of the supersymmetry vanishes. And those are special states in the Hilbert space, which are massive. They're not massless, but they have this special vanishing. And that's what's called a BPS state. And we'll see that in terms of fields. We'll see what kinds of classical field equations correspond to saying that that combination of the Q's vanishes. Okay. So that's the preliminaries, general words about fields and about the types of representations that we expect to see from a classical field theory which is supersymmetric. Okay, so now what we want to do is to actually construct a model in three dimensions with this algebra acting classically, just as we did the superparticle, which had in one dimension the supersymmetry. So what we're going to do is work on the superspace. Am I going to do massless or massive? Well, I will do... Well, you see, it's a little bit hard to say because I'm going to look at a map into a curved manifold. So if that manifold is flat, then it's massless, right? But if the manifold is curved, I mean, and I were to expand, then... No, I'm sorry. It'll be massless. I mean, I'm not going to... No, I'll do both. I'm going to put in a potential term also. I'm sorry. I'll do both. Yes? Well, the name comes from a specific model, which has to do with monopoles, right? But I think the way that... Which is non-supersymmetric. But in the supersymmetric version of that theory, they come up to correspond to this. Right. So the name... Without supersymmetry. We'll see that in a simple example. But you could take the supersymmetric model and drop the fermions and just forget that it was there, and you'd have you'd have a model and just change some coefficients so that the supersymmetry is off. Yeah?
So would an example of this be the self-dual?
Yes. Yeah, so we'll see in a minute how the typical case is that we'll get first-order equations rather than the usual second-order equations. That's where first-order equations will come, so you know lots of examples. Okay, other question. Okay, so let me just quickly say what the conventions are here in case you want to try to do these computations yourself. So V will be the three-dimensional vector space with Lorentz metric, the vector space of translations in three-dimensional Minkowski space. S star will be two-dimensional real vector space, which is the spin space. And we have that wedge 2 of S star is trivial because this is SL2R. So it preserves a skew form. And the space V is actually sim 2 of S star in this case. OK, so we use coordinates theta 1 and theta 2, which are odd coordinates, on the space S star, but with the parity reversed. And then we use even coordinates, which I'll write as y11, y12, and y22, are coordinates on V. So the reason I write the coordinates this way is because of this fact that the symmetric product is here. So these are convenient coordinates, and so that the pairing from the symmetric pairing from the spinners to here is just built in to the coordinates. So in other words, it corresponds in a way to a choice of gamma matrices. Now, the left invariant vector fields here that we'll use, the d alpha, then have a simple formula, which is d by d theta alpha minus theta beta d alpha beta. So d alpha beta means the corresponding coordinate differentiations. In terms of standard coordinates, I should have said we can write y11 is x0 plus x1 over 2, y22 is x0 minus x1 over 2, and y12 is x2 over 2. And now if you write out
y21,
and this is the same as y21. So, for example, when we dimensionally reduce, we're going to take x2 to 0. In other words, we're going to take fields which are constant in the x2 spatial direction, and then we'll be left with the coordinates in two-dimensional space. And so these equations are the sort of dual equations to what happens with the vector fields. Okay. So the bracketing of these is the same as the bracketing in the Poincaré algebra, the super Poincaré. Of course, you can just compute that. And finally, we need the tensor, which is this symmetric form. So we have a tensor, which will be called epsilon alpha beta, or epsilon alpha beta. So this is a skew form. This is the skew form on the spinners, which we have, which is invariant. And the convention will be that epsilon 1,2 is equal to epsilon lower 1,2 is equal to 1. Now, there are many awful signs in Greg Moore's shuddering at this convention, and Robert is too. But I became extremely angry when I discovered that physicists, well, I used it, and then I discovered that it doesn't make any sense that physicists often think of these as being opposite. However, when you have a bilinear form on a vector space, there is absolutely no argument about the bilinear form you induce on the dual space. And so there's no argument that these have to be, in fact, equal. Now, since it's a skew form, we would get in trouble if we raise and lower one index, because then we would get a sign depending on what side we do it. When we have a skew form, we get a map to the dual, but depending on which side you plug things into, you get a sign. However, if we raise and lower two indices, there's no choice about sign. So this sign is absolutely one, and it's unconscionable to use anything else. All right. I was... We have no time for a counter-argument. With all the damn signs in this subject, that one is certainly inexcusable. Sorry. Okay. So, all right. So here's our sigma model. So most of the lecture will talk about the sigma model. And as we saw from the representation theory, what we expect to see is a scalar and a spinner. So at the very end, I hope to have time to tell you about the gauge theory. But I have most to say about the sigma model. Now, we'll formulate the theory on the superspace. And, of course, the idea there is that we have the whole super Poincaré group, this P3/2, acting on the superspace. And so if I can write my field as a function here, then that group will act by pullback on the space of functions. And if I write down a Lagrangian, I can try to make it manifestly invariant under that action. And that's what we'll do, and therefore we'll have something which is manifestly supersymmetric. Then we could do all of our computations of currents and so on in that framework, and it's really geometrically manifestly supersymmetric. However, we need to convert that to ordinary fields on Minkowski space. That's the way we saw the model on Tuesday, where I had the X and the psi. We had two different fields, and the supersymmetry was non-manifest. I mean, it wasn't clear why we had this funny transformation between them. So this is the formulation that makes the supersymmetry manifest, but then we need to understand how to get, in terms of the ordinary formulation, in terms of ordinary fields on Minkowski space, where the supersymmetry isn't manifest. So there's a whole geometry there, and let me just try to indicate something about that. So the field is going to simply be a map from this superspace into X, where, remember, X is a Riemannian manifold. And to begin with, I'll take no potential. So the first question is, how do we go from this field to the components? Well, you remember in the very first lecture, we had this is a space with nilpotents, and this maps into some space like this. The simplest space with nilpotents was just a point whose ring of functions was had an epsilon in it, where epsilon squared is 0. You could think of epsilon being even in ordinary algebraic geometry or anti-commuting. It doesn't matter. And when we map that into a manifold, we got a point of the manifold, but the epsilon gives us a tangent vector. And so we get that tangent vector by, so to speak, differentiating the map in the epsilon direction. Right? That's how we get the tangent vector. So here we have a map of Minkowski space, M3, into X. That would be if I forget these odd coordinates. And now I have two of them, so I would expect to get really two tangent vectors differentiating in those directions. And then I expect to get something else, because I can then take the derivative in one direction followed by the other. And because of the nilpotency, that's all that I would expect to see. So the picture is that we have this super Minkowski space, which is, after all, flat. And we have a map into X, which is curved. And then we have these sort of fuzzy directions. And I won't try to draw the fuzz to obscure things. But we have these vector fields d alpha. Get another color here. Yeah, so we have these vector fields d alpha, which are these odd vector fields that point out. Of course, we also have these vector fields d alpha beta that are the standard translations, which are in that submanifold. But we have these other ones that point out. And so to speak, they point straight out when we're sitting on that submanifold, because theta is 0, and so they're just the d by d theta. But on the other hand, as we move off, they tend to curve, and that's why they have non-trivial brackets. I mean, if they just pointed out, they would have trivial brackets. And so what we want to do then is differentiate our map, which is called capital phi, in the direction of these d's, and then restrict the answer to Minkowski space. So the first field we get, so these are what are called the component fields of the superfield. So this is sometimes called the superfield. And then we get what are called the component fields. And we get it. So here, we'll just get an ordinary scalar field by taking this map phi and just restricting it to Minkowski space. So we'll let I denote the inclusion of ordinary Minkowski space into this super mode. Okay. So that's the ordinary scalar field. But now we can do something, which is to differentiate this and then restrict it. Right? Now, this is odd. We're taking an odd derivative, so we expect to get an odd field. And what we'll get is a spinner field, psi alpha. So each of the d alphas gives us an odd function. The psi takes values in tangent vectors because we've differentiated. It's the usual thing. If I have a map between manifolds and I differentiate, I get a tangent vector over here. And now it should be thought of as odd. And finally, the two together transform as a spinner. And in fact, they transform in S, not S star. In this case, they're the same, but really it's S. Finally, we should differentiate twice. So if I differentiate twice, once I differentiate once, I get a map from here into the tangent space, or a section of the pullback tangent bundle. So the second derivative, I have to use the covariant derivative on X to do the second derivative. I won't make a separate notation. That's understood. And that's a field called F. And there's a particular combination, which is minus 1 half epsilon alpha beta d alpha d beta phi, which is a convenient one to use. So we have these component fields. Now, if you think in terms of the representation we talked about, when we quantize So the simplest case where x is just the real numbers, and then it's free, and we expect to get exactly that. And when we quantize, we expect to get one scalar and one spinner. That's what we would get from phi and psi. And so the question is, what is the f doing there? Well, we'll see that the f is doing here nothing from the point of view of quantization. It won't give us anything. It's what's called an auxiliary field. But it's there. It's certainly part of this map when we have the superspace formulation. And if we were just working in components and we tried to make the supersymmetry, we would find, just as we found in that example of the harmonic oscillator, that we wouldn't close. There it was the group UN. Here it's the super Poincaré group. It wouldn't close until I put in an extra field, F. And then we'll find that the algebra closes even without the equations of motion. Yeah, sure. So So psi, which is psi alpha times some basis of spinners, E alpha. So there was a basis chosen of S. So E alpha is actually a basis of S. This is a section over Minkowski space of the spin bundle. So here it's just trivial vector space of Minkowski space. It's the only one we've talked about. We haven't X think of as CP2, not spin. There's no spinners on X. Tensor the pullback by phi of the tangent bundle of X. Yeah. Sorry, so that's what psi is. And this is, of course, odd. And the odd goes there. Well, the odd can go anywhere you want, sorry. Right, so now there's a theorem that you can go back and forth between maps capital phi, these superfields, and this multiplet of fields. And that's the game when you have these superfields, is you want to find the component fields so that you can go back and forth in a one-to-one way. Okay? So again, I'm just going to try to sketch some of the highlights of how it goes. I can't possibly hope to. Yeah. Right. So, for example, there are automorphisms of the superspace. Those automorphisms involve these sorts of vector fields. So I could move the copy of M hat inside this bigger space that I haven't drawn. And if I moved the copy and did the same formulas, you would see mixed up formulas. So these formulas depend on a choice of coordinates. Everything I write really depends on the choice of coordinates. Okay. Now, the next thing we might want to know is, how does the supersymmetry act? So, in general, you see, we're working. So we're doing our field theory. We're doing calculus on the space-time across the space of fields, which is the space of phi. Or, in components, we're doing calculus on Minkowski space across the space of fields, which are phi, psi, and f. So we have these two pictures of doing the field theory. In this picture, when we want to see how the supersymmetry acts, we move the points of M, and we pull back the fields by the inverse. In this picture, when we want to see how it acts, well, we're not going to move the points of Minkowski space, because after all, these vector fields are going to move us off. So we can't do that, but rather we're just going to move the fields. And so we have to know, how do we get the formula that tells us how do we move the fields? That's the formula that I wrote last time about x dot and psi. Well, remember that the supersymmetries are these Qs. And so, in other words, we have a left action of the Poincaré group on here. These Ds are not the vector fields generated by that action. These Ds correspond to the other action. But the left action is the vector field, which is d by d theta alpha with a plus sign, theta alpha beta, theta beta, d alpha beta. Okay, those are the vector fields Q, and these commute with the Ds. And so, what we want to do to see how that acts on the component fields is that we want to act, we want to move the space. So we have to think of moving by the associated diffeomorphism. And again, I can't exponentiate odd things. The only things that make sense are even things. So again, I have to introduce some odd parameter and consider eta times q. And that can exponentiate to a diffeomorphism. That moves around the space, and I pull back the field, and then I again compute the components. Right? And then I just differentiate in a one-parameter group of diffeomorphisms. And so then I'll see how these component fields move when I do that. Now, the general formula you get, if you do that, so it's useful just to know what the general formula is. So in general, a component field F has a formula which is just the restriction of some combinations of the D's applied to some superfield. So I'll just write D to the R, meaning some specific combination. You can see that's what those formulas look like. And so this vector field corresponding to this Q, well, corresponding to eta alpha Q alpha, let's say. So that's with the parameter. This will be minus eta alpha times the restriction of d alpha dr phi. So what have I done? You see, I've moved phi, but I've moved it by the inverse. So I've exponentiated minus eta Q. Right, because remember, we pull back fields by the inverse to get the left action. That left action commutes with the D. So it's the same thing. I can move that diffeomorphism over to the left because the Qs and the Ds commute since they're left and right invariant. And then I differentiate, and so I would get Q alpha dr phi. But finally, the Qs, when I restrict, set theta equal to 0, the Q and the D are the same. Dr just means some combination of Ds, RDs. So it's just a generic symbol that means those Ds. And so that's just the general formula for how you can see to go from the manifest supersymmetry to the supersymmetry in components. So there's no guesswork when you have the superspace to write how the components transform.
How does little f impinge on?
It should be a positive left, right?
No, no. Oh, sorry, F is here. Sorry, thank you. And finally, of course, the exercise is then to rewrite this in terms of component fields, because our component fields all look like this. So we'll use whatever identity is about these Ds and bracketing and so on to rewrite that in terms of component fields. So in this example, I'll let you do the following computation. And finally, the way that F transforms is a little more complicated. That's eta alpha dirac psi alpha plus 1/3 epsilon beta gamma. Then we have the curvature, one of these expressions that you love, psi beta, and then psi gamma. Yeah, I really think of exponentiating.
Can I just take the formula for the derivative in coordinates and write it out like the same answer?
If you do the geometry carefully, I guarantee you'll get the same answer. I mean, it's just the problem that I have a function on a manifold, I have a submanifold, right? And now I have some vector fields, and I define functions on the submanifold by differentiating along these vector fields. Now I have another vector field that commutes with these and gives me a motion, and I want to apply that and see how those derivatives change. Odd is purely, you know, that's a red herring in that differential geometry problem. So solve that differential geometry problem. The fact that they're odd doesn't matter. And whatever formula you get, that's how you can compute these things. But it's just that sort of differential geometry problem. And finally, the formula you need here for the Dirac operator is minus epsilon beta gamma d alpha beta psi gamma. All right. So there, if you want to stretch your legs, that's what you can do. So notice that if we didn't have the F, then we wouldn't have this term. We wouldn't have cared about this formula. And so we would have had that the derivative of the boson is the spinner, and the derivative of the spinner, I'm sorry, the variation of the boson is the spinner. The variation of the spinner is the derivative of the boson. And that's what we had last time when we had the formula in one dimension. But here, we just had one supersymmetry in one dimension. Now we have two supersymmetries. And so we pick up this auxiliary field, this real auxiliary field, and that mixes in with these. So this really, if you do the brackets and so on, you can check that you really recover the right supersymmetry algebra. Okay. So that's the first ingredient, is knowing what the field is and knowing how the symmetry acts on the field. The second ingredient is, of course, the Lagrangian.
F, capital F, is, should be thought of as a section over the council space of now, of course, this, the second exterior power of S, tensor, again, pull back to the tangent bundle.
Right. If I have a function to a manifold and I differentiate once, I get a section of the pullback. If I have another vector field, I differentiate again, I still get a section of the tangent bundle. Right. I use the Levi-Civita connection. Right. So this D is a covariant derivative. And as far as the second exterior power of the spinners go, that's trivialized.
Right.
Now, it's possible that if you considered orientation reversing things, that thing is not quite a function, but it's a... Okay, I'm not going to say about that, but if we do orientation like so. Okay, so the Lagrangian is now, remember, we're doing the mechanics on M32 cross F, so it should be, for every value of the field, phi, it should be a density on M32. And so to give you a good discussion, we would have to know how to integrate over M32. I'm not going to give you that discussion, but... In any case, I'll write the formula. So this is some sort of density on the super Minkowski space, and it's in density which is invariant under the super Poincaré group, just as D3X is a density on ordinary Minkowski space invariant under the ordinary Poincaré group. And this is then just a function. So this has the form of a function times this density. And, well, okay, there's the function. Now you can check that that's invariant under the Poincaré group, which means it commutes with the vector fields Q. Or I hope I called them tau Q. Yeah, the ones I called tau Q. And they commute because the Ds and the Qs commute, basically. Well, you can give some general argument, but that's the basic reason. So this is a Lagrangian, which will be manifestly invariant under the supersymmetry. And again, the problem is that we want to rewrite this Lagrangian in terms of the ordinary fields, the component fields, as a Lagrangian on ordinary Minkowski space. So we have our picture of Minkowski space sitting here. And now we have this sort of bigger superspace with the fuzz around it. And we have to integrate this density over this whole thing. And we really have, because of our coordinates, a distinguished projection from M32, we have a distinguished projection to here. So instead of doing the integration in one fell swoop, we want to use the Fubini theorem or whatever to integrate over the fibers here, which is to say integrate over the thetas, and then we'll get a density in ordinary space, which will be our Lagrangian density. So the question is, how do we integrate over the thetas? Well, there, of course, we have to discuss about integration of fermionic variables, which is a discussion that everyone has seen, I think, in various forms. And I'm not, as I said, going to give you that discussion. But I will say the following, that what we're going to do is we find a combination of the Ds such that if I integrate over the fibers this density, then that's the same thing as applying this combination. So this combination I'll call D to the S. So there will be some string of Ds, and if I had S supersymmetries, there will be S of them, because I have S thetas to integrate over. And so there will be some string so that I apply it to this function, this Lagrangian function, and I restrict to Minkowski space. And in a good case, that will actually be the same as integrating. In a bad case, or not so bad case, that will be off by some differential operator. And I'll get then the density here, where delta is a Poincaré, so Pn, ordinary Pn, invariant differential operator on ordinary Minkowski space. So, for example, if I just have one theta, then I'm saying that the integral over d theta of some quantity is the same thing as applying d and then restricting, where d is something like d by d theta, plus or minus some thetas and so on. Well, when I apply d by d theta, when I apply this d, I mean, and I apply this term, because I have a theta here and I'm restricting to set theta to 0, that's what I star does, this term doesn't even matter. So all I'm doing is really applying d by d theta. And you probably know that integrating is the same as differentiating. That's the basic rule for fermionic integration. So this formula is just a fancier version when I have more thetas of saying that integrating in d theta is the same as differentiating. Now, you'd like to think that really what you want to do, as I said, is to integrate, is to compute your component Lagrangian by actually integrating over the fibers. But we want to get Lagrangians in general which just have first derivatives of the fields. And if we do that, we might get, instead of a d phi term, we might get phi Laplacian phi or something like that. And so it's to eliminate those terms that we judiciously choose this choice of these and then put the bad term, so to speak, in here. Okay.
Does this correspond to doing some sort of integration by parts in the original harmonic term?
Exactly. So this would be the integration by parts. So in other words, we define... Yeah, it certainly depends.
And what's an example of delta?
Tomorrow. So we define the component Lagrangian, I'll use this notation, to be... So the example is if I integrate d4 theta. Today, it'll be the same. Today, the example is today, this delta will be 0. Yes, so the sigma model in four dimensions would be the example. Okay. So this, first of all, it makes computations much easier because you see it's much easier to compute this. Because let's picture computing this. Well, you see I have to apply some string of d's to an expression like this and then restrict. Well, so I get some string of d's. I already have some d's in the Lagrangian. And now what do I have to do? I have to restrict. Well, that's an expression in terms of component fields because the component fields are restrictions of derivatives of the fields. So I just have to manipulate this thing and see what combination of component fields I get. So we don't really use this to define the Lagrangian, but we just use that term. All right. So then again, you can try your wits at calculating all these sorts of things. I just have to tell you what's the particular combination we use in this case. Of course, you can't use an arbitrary combination. I mean, you have to make a combination which agrees with the integration up to this total derivative term. So in M32, we use the definition that this L hat is minus 1/2 epsilon alpha beta, well, the restriction of this, d alpha d beta, applied to L. So remember, L is the function that sits in front of the density in my superspace Lagrangian. I apply this combination, this is 2D's, in the same combination that appeared in F, 2D's to this L. The sign is some sort of choice of orientation there, and we get that. Okay. Well, no. I practiced a lot. But I mean, no, I think it's pretty standard sort of thing.
No, but what? So the L hat is now, again, a function downstairs?
So L hat is a function on ordinary Minkowski space, and then the Lagrangian density is just that times the standard density.
Pretty clearly, you're going to have to use a D1 and a D2.
Right.
There's two ways to do it.
And I've averaged them. But this is the combination that gives good answers. In other words, if I had used just d1, d2, I would have gotten some total derivatives I didn't want. So this is the combination that, with the way of writing the Lagrangians, gets rid of the total derivatives. So just as an example, so of course your exercise is to take that Lagrangian, that expression, and compute it in components. I'll tell you the answer in a second. But a typical term you might get would be to restrict something like d1, d2, d1 phi, d2 phi. So that's the term you'll get. You see, if alpha is 1 and beta is 2, you have a d1 phi, d2 phi, and I have to apply two more d's, which are different because that's skew. So I might get a term like that. And if you work it out, then in components, this turns out to be something like d11 psi 2 psi 2 minus twice d12 psi 1 psi 2 plus one of your favorite terms, r psi 1 psi 2 psi 1 psi 2. All right. So I just gave you one term in the computation just so you could check an intermediate step. But if you do the whole computation, then in this example, of course, there are systematic shortcuts that you... I mean, eventually, this computation is a few lines once you do the right preparations. But in any case, the Lagrangian you get is 1 half d phi squared plus 1 half psi drac psi plus 1 twelfth epsilon alpha beta epsilon gamma delta psi alpha psi beta psi gamma psi delta plus 1 half f squared d3x. All right, there it is. So that's the final answer in terms of components. So again, what I've tried to show you is a typical example of how you write a superfield for one of these sigma models in superspace, how you define the component fields, how you see the supersymmetries and how they act, how you define the Lagrangian, and then from that go to the component Lagrangian. And so I want to spend the rest of the lecture not doing computations. That's not very enlightening to watch. I've given you the principles. But rather to analyze this model and then see what happens. Let's talk about a little bit the physics. Now, if we first think about the case when the target is the reals, for example, then this term is out, of course. I don't have any curvature. And this is just my free scalar. This is my free spinner. Those were the Lagrangians we wrote last time. And then we have a term which is 1 half f squared. Now, if we compute the equations of motion by varying this, differentiating in the fields, of course, the equation of motion of f is just f equals 0. So that's what I promised at the beginning, that it would play no role. It's just an auxiliary field. So the equation of motion is that f is equal to 0. That holds no matter what the target is. F in this Lagrangian is not interacting with anything, so it just has its own Lagrangian there. And the equation of motion is clearly f equals 0. So it's algebraic, in this case, extremely simple. So once we eliminate f, and usually when we write component Lagrangians, we'll eliminate the f, then if the target were r, we would just have this, which is, as I promised, one scalar and one spinner. So that's the representation of Poincaré, which we saw at the beginning, this massless scalar multiply. In a little while, we'll put in a potential. We could get the massive scalar multiply. Now, you see that supersymmetry, when we have a curved target, forces this curvature term. So before, we saw a curvature term in the equation of motion. But now, with two supersymmetry terms, we actually see a curvature term in the Lagrangian, as well as in the transformation law for the fields. Okay. Now, the other thing that we want is, as I did at the beginning, when we just had a purely bosonic Lagrangian, we wrote down the energy density. And really, a more complete physical discussion would have had the momentum density and the other angular momentum density, the other components of the Lorentz group. Here, when we have a supersymmetric theory, we also want to write down the current, which corresponds to the Qs. That's called the supercurrent. So here we go. So the supercurrent is minus, so there's the minus sign, just as the Hamiltonian is minus d by the current associated to time translation, the supercurrent will be minus the current of the supersymmetry. And so we can do all of them at once by just putting in that parameter. And so that supercurrent, well, anyway, we could just write the formula for Q alpha, I guess. And so this is, hopefully, epsilon beta delta epsilon gamma epsilon, so sorry about the two epsilons, times d alpha delta phi psi epsilon minus eta beta epsilon alpha gamma f psi alpha. And then we have this expression. Okay, So this is the inertial current, and you can calculate this in two ways, because we can do the field theory in the superspace, or we could do the field theory in components. The eta beta is, oh, I see. Okay. No. So, sorry, the eta has to be there, I guess, to write the formula. So that's the supercurrent, like that. And what does this mean? Well, the supercurrent, remember, is something we integrate over space, over two dimensions. So from the point of view of three dimensions, it's an n minus two, it's a two form. That is to say, it's a density times a vector. So here's the vector, the translation vector, times the three density. So that's a density. So in other words, this has different components. So physicists usually write J0 for the time component, J1, J2. So here I've written them, remember my indices are like that. Anyway, that's some general formula, so it's much more of a challenge to compute that one than to compute the previous formulas. But if we want to integrate the, if we want to get the charges, then we have to integrate that over the, we integrate the time component. So we integrate that over a space slice where x0 is constant. So out of that two form, which has three functions, we only pick out one of them, and then the formula simplifies. So I'm sorry, I wrote Q for that. That's really... not Q. That's the current, which would be J eta alpha Q alpha. So that's the current. And then the formula for Q, let me just write them because we'll need them, is that this is the integral over space slice of d11 phi psi 1 plus d12 phi psi 2 dx1 dx2. And then q2 is equal to the integral of d22 phi psi 2 plus d12 phi psi 1 dx1 dx2. So in writing these formulas, I've set F to 0 using the equation of motion. So again, we only want to analyze energy or momentum or so on classical solutions. So we use the equations of motion. So here I've set F equal to 0. These are the charges that go with the symmetries. Right. So the space of classical solutions is some sort of symplectic supermanifold, and we can get the associated charges, associated functions that go with the Hamiltonian vector fields. So those are the functions. Okay, so to get something that's more physically interesting, you see here, what's the moduli space of our particle? Well, so again, if we wanted to minimize the energy, well, we would have the fermions don't enter. The fermions classically are always set to 0. And the boson we have is the scalar phi, and it would just sit at a point of x. So the moduli space would just be x. So there's nothing much interesting until we introduce a potential. So for a potential, let's let h be a function from x to the reals. And then the Lagrangian is equal to what we had before plus a term which is just phi star of h, very simple, v3x, v2 theta. Okay. So in superspace, we can easily write the potential term. We just pull back the function. That's the same sort of potential term that we usually write in our ordinary bosonic signal model, as I wrote before, except we would have written it with a minus sign. Okay, now you can work out the contribution again once you integrate of this new term. So the new term contributes. Well, it contributes a term with f, which is f phi star of the gradient of h. So f, as Robert pointed out, is a vector in the target, and so is the gradient of this function. We take their inner product. And contributes that term plus another Hessian term, which I'll write in a moment, but I won't right now. But recall that the component Lagrangian up there has a 1/2 norm f squared, and here now we get a linear term. So the equation of motion of F is now non-trivial, but it's just an algebraic function. It's just minus this term. So the equation of motion for F is now F is equal to minus phi star grad. There's another term.
Oh.
Sorry. I'll write it in a second, but I didn't. Okay. It doesn't involve F. Yeah.
Oh.
All right. I mean, it's quicker to just write it. So it's 1/2 epsilon alpha beta phi star of the Hessian of H applied to psi alpha psi beta. So that's some sort of covariant Hessian using the Levi-Civita connection. So the point I want to make is that we eliminate this F now not to be 0, but to be minus phi star grad H. So, of course, that will have a consequence, for example, in our supercurrent, because now that formula appears. It also has a consequence in the formulas that are gone for the transformations of the fields, because remember, those involved F. And now the transformations of the fields under the supersymmetry will also involve the potential function. So what is the component Lagrangian we get? So the component Lagrangian we get has the same three terms we had before. And now, instead of this term, we get a new term. So we get minus 1/2 phi star of dH squared. And then we get this Hessian term, which is 1/2 epsilon alpha beta times phi star of the Hessian of H psi alpha psi beta. So this is just the term we computed there. And the other term is what we get when we eliminate F by combining this term and this term using the equation of motion. So again, the component Lagrangian involves the F, but we use the equation of motion to rewrite it as so. So there's a non-trivial equation for the auxiliary field, and that's typical. OK, so now what's the physics of this Lagrangian? Well, it's only on the solution manifold for F, but it's valid for phi and psi. So it's the theory you get of phi and psi, but I've only eliminated F. I haven't used the equations of motion for the other. So if you were to write the Lagrangian with F, which you could, that would be an equivalent Lagrangian. Right? It's just that writing the Lagrangian in this form is more physically evident what's going on. I mean, the first step you would do if you got the other Lagrangian is convert to this one. So the component Lagrangian, as we defined it, is the other one, where I have not these yellow terms, but I still have a half F squared, and I have these terms. And I have the whole set of fields, phi, psi, and F. But then I can write a new Lagrangian, which is really a simple example of an effective Lagrangian, for phi and psi, solving for the classical equations of F. And this is the effective Lagrangian for phi and psi. It'll have the same classical solutions, right?
Same possible.
Yes, yes. Yes. Okay. Well, that'll stop bothering you if you do the path integral in Minkowski space, I think. Then you get a Doppler function. You'll just get the equation of motion that F is 0. So if you... In Euclidean space, it's funny, but that's right. Okay. So the new features of the physics are that now we have a potential energy for the scalar. Notice it showed up with the correct sign, which is a minus. We expect the potential energy to be a minus sign in the Lagrangian. And the potential energy is the V of phi is 1/2 phi star dH squared. Sorry, so the potential energy is that function. It's a function on x, and it's just that function. So first of all, notice that this is non-negative, which is what I promised you supersymmetry guarantees. And the second thing we have is we have a mass term for the fermions.
It's a function on manifold, not M.
So it's a function on X. Oh, sorry. Well, phi takes values in X, so I might have labeled the coordinates, but. All right. Well, V. Okay. And we have a mass term for the fermions, which is this quadratic term here. So instead of having massless fermions, which is what we had before, we had no second-order term. We have fourth-order term, but that's not a mass term. But now we have a mass term for the fermions. And the mass term and the potential are, of course, related to the same function, H. Okay, and as I commented before, well, okay, so the supersymmetry transformations are that phi is, again, minus eta alpha psi alpha, but psi is now eta beta of the alpha beta phi plus epsilon alpha beta phi star grad H. So the minimal energy configurations occur at critical points of H, right? So that's what we found before, right? The minimal energy configurations were at minima of V, and those are the critical points of H. Now, at the critical points of H, we have, therefore, the those are the vacuums. So if H is a Morse function, we just have these points on the space H. And notice that if we're at a critical point, then, of course, phi is constant. This derivative vanishes. Psi is, in any case, zero. And the gradient of H is also zero. So that means that that field configuration of the phis and the psis is killed by this vector field. The symmetry vanishes at that point. In other words, that field configuration is invariant under the supersymmetry. So that's what they call a supersymmetric vacuum, or to say that supersymmetry is unbroken in that vacuum, meaning that we're standing in a field configuration which is annihilated by all the supersymmetry. Quantum mechanically, that would be a state in the Hilbert space, and all the operators would be zero. The supersymmetry operators would be zero. Classically, the supersymmetry is a vector field on this manifold of classical solutions, and we're sitting at a point, that's our classical vacuum, where the vector field vanishes. So that's an unbroken supersymmetry is that case. Okay, if we have a critical manifold, then we have a tangent space, and then we have some massless scalars. So the massless scalars, well, you would see them when you expand the Lagrangian. You would see that the potential had some degenerate directions. So it's the Hessian of the potential which gives you the mass of the scalar field. So you would see that at those points you had massless scalars, and you would again have massless fermions, and they would match. You see, in both cases, you would be looking at the Hessian. Here you would be looking at the Hessian of H to compute the mass of these scalars, and the mass term for the fermions is the one with the Hessian. So again, the masses of the bosons and fermions will match, and they have to by supersymmetry. And you can see that classically here. You can also look at other critical points of V. So, I need that for you. So we just looked at the minima of V, but we could look at other critical points of V just to demonstrate one other physical idea. So the differential of V is something like grad H inner product covariant derivative of grad H. And So we have critical points, of course, where the gradient of H is equal to zero. But we might have a critical point where the gradient of H isn't zero, but the gradient of H is perpendicular to its derivative, right? And so at such a point, the gradient of H isn't zero, and therefore this vector field, which is the supersymmetry transformation, doesn't vanish. And so that's a point which has broken supersymmetry. So we might have solutions where the global symmetry, the supersymmetry, is broken. In other words, not all the supersymmetries vanish. So in the bosonic case, you see, if we have a symmetry acting on some manifold, and we're looking for the minimum of some potential, if we have a point which is invariant under the symmetry, that's fine. That's a point where the symmetry doesn't move us. But if some of the symmetry is broken, then we'll sweep out a whole manifold of minima by using the symmetry group. We'll get a homogeneous space. So we're guaranteed to get some manifold of minima. And in particular, the tangent space, then, will be massless scalars. Those are what are called Goldstone bosons. And here we have the supersymmetry. And here we haven't killed all the supersymmetry. So the supersymmetry will also move and give us some other critical points. And we have to have tangents to those. But since the supersymmetry is odd, the tangents will be odd directions. So they'll be fermions. So we expect to see massless fermions. And indeed, if we have such a point, you can see that that means that we have a kernel to the Hessian of H. That's the Hessian of H. And the kernel is exactly the massless fermions. And so those are what are called Goldstone fermions. Okay. And finally, the supercharges get a correction term due to the potential. So that was the term that I left off before. And this will be, I hope, minus phi star grad H, that was the F, psi 2, and then we have plus phi star grad H, psi 1. Okay. Now the next thing I want to do is to reduce this theory to two dimensions. So that's the end of the discussion in three dimensions. So if there are any questions about that, so let me move on to two dimensions. So in two dimensions, we want to basically set D12 of the fields, phi psi f, to be 0. So we want to do the field theory. Think of doing the field theory on Minkowski 3 space, but we're setting the fields to be constant in one of the spatial directions. And now we'll just change the notation. Everywhere you see an index 1, we'll change it to a plus, and everywhere we see the index 2, we'll change it to a minus. That's the usual notation in two dimensions. So then you can just use the same formulas and just erase the terms which aren't there. So the Lagrangian, for example, will look exactly the same, except if you expanded it out and plugged in for the indices, of course, you would see less terms. You wouldn't see the 1-2 terms. The supersymmetry transformations we'll need, so let me write those down. So we'll see that phi changes by... phi changes by minus eta plus psi plus eta minus psi minus. Psi plus changes by eta plus d plus phi plus eta minus phi star grad h. Remember, we had an f in that formula previously, and now we have the potential appearing, derivative of the potential. And then the other spinner, psi minus, is eta minus d minus phi minus eta plus phi star grad h. And now the supercharges are q plus is the integral of d plus phi psi plus minus d star grad h psi minus. And now we're just integrating dx1. And then q minus is some similar expression, which is d minus phi psi minus plus now d star grad h psi plus dx1. Okay. So again, we have the same story about the critical points, the moduli space. The minimum of the potential will still be at the critical points of our function. We can think of it as a Morse function. And again, we have the same story about the symmetry breaking and so on. But the new feature here is that we can compute the Poisson bracket of q plus and q minus. So remember, we went from the symmetries, which act on the space of solutions, to these functions, which is lifting in a symplectic manifold. And in general, we expect we might see a central extension when we take the Poisson brackets. The functions on a symplectic manifold under Poisson bracket is a central extension of the vector fields. So here we have an explicit example, and we can compute this. So to compute that, you have to know how to Poisson bracket these sorts of things. Or you can, you know, one way to compute the Poisson bracket is to take the vector field of one function and apply it to the other function. That's much easier because you have the formulas here for the vector field, so you just apply that vector field to this function. If you do that, you find that you don't get 0, but rather you get something which is minus 2 times the space derivative of pullback of h dx1. So that's just integrating a total derivative. So this is just minus 2 times h at infinity minus h at minus infinity. And this is, of course, what we define to be the central charge, Z. So if we have a finite energy configuration, first of all, it's not supposed to be flowing in time. So it's just a map of line, the space. We're in two space-time dimensions, so we have a map of one space dimension into our manifold. And if we're to have finite energy at both ends, it better go to a point of zero potential energy. Otherwise, we'll have infinite energy. That means it has to go to a critical point at each end. So this is a flow line on the manifold. This is some kind of line which flows from one critical point to the other. If it flows to the same critical point, then the central charge is zero. Well, sorry, same critical value, then it's zero. And what the central charge measures is the difference in the critical values. And now we could ask that we have finally a VPS state, which would be asking that the combination Q plus plus Q minus, or Q plus minus Q minus, vanishes on that flow line. So in other words, if we look at finite energy flow lines, so here's our manifold, we have some critical points, and if I have a map N, which is constant in time, and finite energy, it has to go between the flow lines. Well, it would cost infinite energy to move these endpoints. I mean, I couldn't possibly move these endpoints. So the space of these static field configurations is disconnected. So, of course, we have configurations that go like this, and then we have the minimal ones, which are the constant ones, and those are the vacua, right? Those are the vacua. I mean, those have zero energy. But if we look in these other components, then we have space of fields that does this. So we have a big space of fields, possible paths that goes from this critical point to this critical point. All of them have positive energy. It's got to cost some energy to go from here to here. But we can look for the minimal energy one in that sort of topologically non-trivial sector. So the minimal one, energy one, we know how to look for because we have this BPS bound that we could write classically, we don't have time, says that the mass, the Hamiltonian, is larger than or equal to the absolute value of the central charge. And so we could try to saturate that bound, which is equivalent to asking that Q plus Q minus vanish. So we could compute just from these formulas what the vector field Q plus Q minus or Q minus is. And what you find, as you can sort of readily see from these formulas, is, well, you have to add these. And remember, D plus D minus, or you have to subtract these, rather. D plus minus D minus is just the spatial derivative. And so we'll just get the spatial derivative of phi plus or minus the gradient. And asking that that vanish is just the equation for a flow line, right? That's just the equation that would be a flow line of the gradient of H. So in other words, the minimal energy configuration to get from here to here is just the flow line. That's a BPS state, classically. And so that's a first-order equation. The equations of motion are second-order. They have to do with the wave equation applied to phi. But for these BPS states, we get the first-order. So that's what's called a soliton. And because of the supersymmetry, it has this first-order equation. It's the minimal energy configuration here, just as the vacuum is a minimal energy configuration, but it's in this topologically non-trivial sector, so it has positive energy. But still, it's at the bottom of what's nearby. So it's thought to be stable and behave like a particle, just as sitting there somehow is stable in time. Having a flow line is something which is stable in time. So I think that's the simplest example of one of these BPS states. When you quantize, you're supposed to get those representations we talked about, the massive ones which have the smaller algebra. So this is the first-order equation, and of course other examples are other first-order equations we know. What happens in the odd directions is, well, since it's not a supersymmetric vacuum, and it's not invariant under the other supersymmetries, so again, the other supersymmetries move us and give us some moduli space, and so I guess we would expect at that point to see some massless fermions. So I didn't try to compute it, but I guess that's what we must see, no?
So do you get maybe a parallel?
Well, no, no. It's not what? Well, the fermions are put to zero, yeah. I mean, we're not at a vacuum, so it's not, sorry, I mean... Yeah, I don't know what to say. I mean, we get a little moduli space in general of these things. So when we quantize, we might get, we would have to quantize that manifold of BPS states, really, right? I mean, it's that manifold that would somehow quantize to give us the quantum Hilbert space. But I don't know what, yeah, I don't know if you.
Couldn't there be non-trivial fermions with this boson?
Sure.
With your BPS state?
Well,
I mean, I would imagine parallel tangent vectors along the gradient flow. Maybe I could take any tangent vector, the perpendicular.
It's just the manifold of
at what is it parallel?
Well, I mean, bosonically, what would it be? Sometimes we know that we get not a critical one flow line, but we get a manifold.
Suppose we just have one flow line.
Then I think it's just an isolated point, but then we get some super direction also, right?
Is that
what?
Did you
Yeah, I mean, yeah, okay. Some combination of the fermions would vanish by that. But the other combination...
But it looks like you have one independent variable, which would be an arbitrary fermion at one point.
Yeah, I think you have one fermion left over. Okay. So final remark is what happens if we reduce now to one dimension. So if we reduce to one dimension, then, well, we get rid of the spatial direction, so we ask that things be constant in the spatial direction, so we only have time, and we're back to our superparticle, except now we're at the superparticle which has two supersymmetries. There's a psi plus and a psi minus, whereas the one that we started with just had one. So this is a model which is sort of 1/2, and again, when we quantize the one that had one supersymmetry, we saw heuristically we got the Dirac operator. If we quantize this one, we'll get, because we have two spinners, we get the square of the spinners, and so we get differential forms, and we actually get the Derome complex. And so one of the supersymmetries is d plus d star, and the other one is I times d minus d star, where d is Derome d. And so that's the supersymmetric quantum mechanics that Robert started with in his lecture. It's the one with the two supersymmetries. And notice that since we reduced from three dimensions down to one dimension, we have a global symmetry, which is the rotation in the two spatial directions. So there's a U1 global symmetry to that theory. And so when we quantize, we get a U1 action on the Hilbert space, which is to say a grating, and that's the usual grating on differential forms. So, so that's the theory with two supersymmetries in three, two, and one dimensions. So next time I'll briefly comment perhaps about the gauge theory, which we didn't do, and we'll go on and discuss theories with more supersymmetry at decreasing levels of specificity. So here I tried to give you how you set up the theory and try to compute, and next time I'm going to just talk more about the Lagrangians and eventually even lop off the fermions just to familiarize you with the different theories, which will really be the background we needed for the lectures earlier this week. Sure. Okay, question.
Two comma zero
in two dimensions. Right, so I said yesterday that we started in three dimensions and dimensionally reduced, and all we'll get in two dimensions are 1,1 theories. But there are also these chiral theories in the non-maximal dimension. Like, so here we would have theories in two dimensions with supersymmetry 2,0. And those you won't get. So I'm not doing a complete catalog in five lectures of all supersymmetric theories. Yeah?
So these symmetry theories you wrote down, that's actually including the auxiliary theory? Because if you eliminate it,
well, this is certainly, I've eliminated F from these, right. There should be another piece here. Well, it's possible, I'm not, you know. All I did here was take the formulas from three dimensions, reduce them to two dimensions, and then plug in the equation of motion for F. Now, if we start taking brackets here, we're not going to get this thing to close off shell because we've eliminated the F. If I use the equations of motion, I'll see back the super Poincaré algebra. But I won't see it without the equations of motion. Now here, you're just asking whether I did the computation properly. I don't promise, but I did actually bracket it. Anyway, there are lots of computations to check, and this is one of the easier models. So it just gives you a flavor for all these awful computations. But... okay.